Berlin Security Beat is an original podcast produced by the Center for National Security at the Hertie School in Berlin. Welcome back to the Berlin Security Beat. In this season, we focus on giving our listeners a comprehensive overview of cybersecurity, from entering the industry, to cyber threats, to diplomacy, policy, and beyond. In today's second episode of our two-parter on cyber threats, we will focus on cybercrime. I interview Rutger Leukfeldt, professor of governing cybercrime at Leiden University, director of the Center of Expertise in Cybersecurity at The Hague University of Applied Sciences, and senior researcher at the Netherlands Institute for the Study of Crime and Law Enforcement. We discuss everything from hackers to criminal nexuses to hacktivists, ransomware, and social engineering. How cybercriminals can differ wildly, ranging from organized groups with corporate structures to opportunistic cyber street gangs. But before we delve into all things cybercrime, I want to ask our listeners if you could please rate us on whatever platform you're listening on, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify. This really helps us stay visible and allows us to keep sharing content with you. And now, let me welcome Rutger Leukfeldt to our podcast. Rutger, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for inviting me. I'm honored.
We're very happy you could make it. Rutger, with your rich background in studying cybercrime and a wide array of publications on the subject, could we start off by breaking down the basics? How would you define cybercrime to someone unfamiliar with it? And what range of criminal activities does it encompass?
Yeah, very good question. There are many definitions. I usually say if I explain it to someone that's not into cybercrime research that technology is changing the ways that criminals are committing crimes, right? And that's a key concept here. And therefore, I always say you got two types of offenses included in the broad term of cybercrime. On the one hand, you have new offenses, new crimes that were not there 30, 40 years ago. And those crimes are aimed at IT and are committed using IT. For example, hacking a database with credit card credentials. That's completely new. Everybody understands that. Or using DDoS attack, so sending a lot of information to a server, so the server explodes. You could not do that before. So those are new crimes that, you know, that we now have because of the benefits of the internet, and the criminals use the opportunities of the internet to commit all sorts of new crimes. And then on the other hand, you have more traditional crimes that are now also being committed using IT. For example, all sorts of frauds. You know, you got the banking phishing schemes, but you also got other frauds in which the online component is now very important for the offender. On the one hand, because it's very scalable to commit crimes, because, you know, you used to be able to fraud one person at a time. Well, now you can send out hundreds of thousands of phishing mails, or you can use malware, which is malicious software to get access to computers of other people, or you use exploits. So you can do it on a very large scale. So although the crime itself isn't new, the way it's committed is new, and therefore I still think it's important to add those traditional crimes with an IT component to the cybercrime umbrella, but it's something different compared to the first category I just mentioned. So to sum up, it's very broad. It's almost everything. And on the one hand, you've got your very technical crimes, and a number of interesting issues come up there, because there we don't know if we're dealing with the same type of offender. Maybe they have different profiles. Maybe they have different background compared to more traditional criminals. We don't know. If that's the case, then you need other interventions, et cetera, et cetera. For the other types of crime, so the second category, we start seeing that they are committed by fairly traditional criminal networks that now adopt cyber into their criminal repertoire and also commit all sorts of digitized forms of crime. So for me as a criminologist, I find both of these interesting, but you could argue that the first category is completely new, completely novel, gets a lot of attention from the cybersecurity industry, and the second one is much less innovative, it's much less interesting from a technological perspective, but from a criminological perspective, it's very intriguing because this gives traditional offenders a wealth of new opportunities to commit their offenses.
Thank you. That's a really great response. I want to build on what you just said, but also step back a little bit. I'm interested in understanding better how cybercriminals operate. Could you maybe demystify some of the jargon and core concepts of cybercrime, such as phishing, spear phishing, ransomware? You know, what are the main tactics, techniques, and procedures, or TTPs as we call them, that cybercriminals employ?
And of course, there are many out there. So I will just start by addressing those that you just mentioned, and feel free to ask additional questions. But I think phishing is something that I've done a lot of research in, so I'll start with that one. And that's fairly simple. Phishing means that you try to, by using digital tools such as email or whatever, that you actually try to get access to something that you're not allowed to get access to. For example, using a phishing email, you pretend to be, for example, sending an email from the bank, while you're, of course, you're a criminal, so you copy and paste the entire outline of your bank's email, or you might even make a phishing website that's a copy of the bank's website. So the person getting the email thinks, hey, this is actually my bank, and they asked me to log in here. And by using those techniques, they basically just try to steal your credentials so they can log in on behalf of you. And this happens with online banking sessions, but also with Netflix accounts or with, all sorts of accounts. So you can use phishing in all sorts of ways, but it basically means that you try using emails or websites to actually, get access to the accounts of other people. And it's a fairly low-tech way of doing it, I would say. Of course, you need to develop an email, or you need to be able to send out a spam run, so send out hundreds of thousands of emails, but you actually have people offering tools to do that. So you don't have to be technical to do that. It's a fairly low-tech concept. And in practice, I also see a lot of traditional criminal groups using it just to make money. Because somebody says, hey, I actually have access to a phishing kit, so let's just try and see if we can scam some people. And they do it. So that about phishing. You can also do it in a more technical way using malware. Malware is malicious software. Everybody knows what software is, right? Malicious software is just software that's used by criminals to do something that you don't want. In this case, usually to take over control of your computer. And if you can take control over a computer, you might also be able to control an internet banking session, or at least you have access to all sorts of potentially interesting data that's on the computer. I don't know what you've got on your computer, but I'm sure if somebody hacks into mine, they will be able to find some interesting details that you can use to defraud other people or to sell or whatever. And malware is simply software that is installed on your computer because you as a user clicked on a link or you downloaded something. And by doing that, you also got some malicious code on your computer. And now the offender actually has some control over your machine. And then you also had a question, I think. So ransomware is a new way to get ransom from people, right? Like 20 years ago, the classical mafia kind of ransom style crimes were come into a shop of somebody and threaten to burn it down, and if you don't want that, then you have to pay. Or they take somebody hostage, and to get them free, you need to pay some money. And in this case, criminals are actually using, well, different ways, but let's say they use encryption to make sure that you don't have access to your files, or you might not even have access to your complete machine. And of course, you want to have access back. In order to do so, you need to pay money, usually via bitcoins of another e-currency. But it's basically, they take hostage your files. And of course, data is now the new gold. So for companies, it's very, very, very important to have access to that data, because that's basically, the business model of a lot of companies. So if somebody is able to actually make sure that you don't have access to data or to your machines, then your company is not able to do what you need to do. On the other end, criminals also now threaten with actually making the stolen data from the companies to make it public. So, you know, there's a lot of shame in that, of course. So that's another new tactic that criminals use besides of taking hostage of your files. They also threaten to dump it on the dark web or whatever. So it's getting more complex, this crime type. But basically it means, you know, you don't have access to your files and it's very important for you. So pay us some money and then you're good to go. That's the business model of ransomware. So it sounds really new, but basically it's a very old mechanism. And it's now used on our IT infrastructure because IT is so important for us as a society. It's so important for companies, but also for individuals. So, yeah, it makes sense that criminals made a shift towards actually using that to extort money from us.
Our audience won't be able to see this, but you have the poster of your book behind you, The Human Factor of Cybercrime. Now, you've placed a lot of emphasis on the human element in your work. Can you elaborate on this concept for us? And why is understanding the human factor important for cybercrime? What drives cybercriminals? I mean, we've mentioned financial motivations, but I'm sure there's more complexity to it as well.
Yeah. Well, I think the importance is I started out, I'm a criminologist, and I've always been interested in computers and hacking and whatever. I think it's fair to say that I've been a script kiddie when I was in my teens, right? But, you know, that was in the 1990s. So, you could not do a whole lot of stuff compared to now. So I'm happy that I'm not growing up now. I'm happy that I grew up in the 80s and 90s. But the key thing is that when I started doing research into this topic as a criminologist, like what I said, it was 2005 or 6 or something like that. I was surprised that the majority, if not all, studies done on cybercriminal activity were done from a technical perspective. So, of course, naturally, computer scientists who were working on computer systems and defending them, they were the first ones to actually see, hey, people are abusing this, there is a virus, there's a worm, how does it work, and stuff like that. But there were no criminologists, sociologists, psychologists actually looking into the topic. And I was really surprised by that. And of course, when you start to dive into the literature, you do see that some people were actually already studying the behavior of hackers and of script kiddies and whatever. But it was nothing compared to the wealth of research that was done from computer science perspective. Well, in the end, I thought back then, and I still believe that cybercrimes are technical in nature because in the modus operandi, there's a technical component, but they are committed by individuals with their own motives, with their own background, with their friends online or offline that influence them. And we need to understand how that works. We need a better understanding of why do people commit these crimes? What are their motives? What is the impact of the digital world on how criminal networks actually grow? For example, what does it mean if you have access to a hacking forum? Does it mean that you have all of the experts in the world available to you? And do you use them or not? And why not, right? I mean, because in theory, because of hacking fora, darknet fora, once you have access to them, the possibilities are without limit. So you can do whatever you want. If you want to have malware from a Russian malware writer, you can buy it. If you want to have a phishing kit, you can get it. If you want money mule networks, you can get it. But not everybody's doing that. Some people are specialized. Some people don't do anything. So I really think it's important to understand the attackers and understand how the networks work. And on the other hand, another part of the human factor approach is we also are looking into victims, and not only victims as the weakest link, what traditionally computer science or the technical brain, you know, sees users as, yeah, they're the dumb people, you know, that make the mistakes. Well, we argue, okay, some people might make mistakes, but is it really a mistake if you click on a link and there's malware in there? Is it really a mistake if you don't recognize a phishing mail, well, you did recognize 99 others. So I started to think much more like, okay, we need to understand how we can make people more resilient against these attacks. And in order to do that, you need to understand why they behave in a certain way. If you can actually make them more aware of what's happening around them, and if making them aware means that they're more resilient or not, because we don't know that. And, you know, so it's a big puzzle. And I think the technical part is very important, but it's just one part of the puzzle. That's why I think it's so important to actually focus on both the offenders and the victims, and use technology as the concept that, you know, integrates all of it. And I think so far we've learned that it's very difficult to actually make people behave more safe, because behavior is not easy to steer. It's not like if you show them this is the risk that they act safer. It's not always that if you give them more information and more knowledge about how to behave safe, that they actually do it. And I think that's key to understand. So we can develop better firewalls, we can make software better, but if people don't use it like the programmers want them to do, yeah, it's senseless, right? So it's a combination of both. And for me, even more important, because this is really, you know, there is some research on users and behavior, but if you look at the research on criminals, we need to do so much in that area. And that's really important, because if you don't understand the motives of an attacker, you don't know if all of the technical or social technical security measures that you develop, if they work, because you don't know if you're dealing with a very persistent offender, how they're dealing with these new bumps in the road on their way to get more money. You just don't know. So that's why I think it's very important to actually have a far better understanding of the offenders and of the victims. And I have to say, I'm very happy to see that the field is expanding and that more and more people actually get interested into these crimes. Because one anecdote about studying cybercrime and studying cybercriminals is that when I moved to the NSCR, which is the biggest European criminological institute, I got a lot of questions saying, what do you do? You research cybercrimes, but you research a very specific crime type. Why do you do that? There's nobody only looking at burglaries, or there's nobody looking only at whatever types of crime, right? We try to research in a different way. And I had to explain to them, it's not about only hacking. It's not about only a DDoS attack. It's about how technology is changing crime and how technology makes sure that now new offenders are able to execute attacks. And if we don't understand that, you know, we don't understand crime in this day and age, because most crimes are now digitalized. And this is slowly but steadily growing, this movement. And I see people that have been doing work for decades on more traditional crimes now also adopt some cybercrimes into their research. And I think that's really important, because we need new scholars like me, but we also need the more traditional scholars to move, or to understand that cyber is part of what they should research.
So let me move on to the structures of criminal networks, such as ransomware groups, but of course others as well. I know that certain cyber criminal networks can even emulate corporate structures, that ransomware groups even have customer, or should I say victim support. They have help desks. They also have professional brokers for network access. They work together. So could you speak about how criminal networks are organized?
Well, I think the ransomware groups are special. So let's talk about them first, because what we definitely do see is that they are very well organized, and they now also use the cybercrime as a service, which you call that a cybercrime as a service framework, in which basically you have developers that develop certain pieces of cybercrime tools. That can be phishing kits that you can use to carry out phishing attacks. That can be ransomware. That can be access as a service. That can be all sorts of things. So what we now see is that we got markets where you can actually buy very highly specialized services that you can use as an attacker or as a group. And we also see that the ransomware groups are doing that. So they make their own ransomware, but they offer it to others to use. And in order to use it, you need to pay and you need to give the ransomware group a fee. So this is a very interesting concept, right? So we are not only dealing with ransomware groups that have the skills themselves to develop the ransomware and carry out the attacks, which also means that it is limited what they can do, because the amount of time that you have as an individual is limited. The amount of money that you can launder is limited. But what they're doing now is they're selling their or renting out their ransomware to other groups to use, so there can be more attacks, there can be more victims, and they actually give the top group a piece of the revenues. So that's a very interesting model, and you see that more and more happening in the cybercrime ecosystem. And what I can say about the ransomware groups, as far as I know, and I've got one of my PhDs who's doing research into this, is that they seem to have a business model more strict than other groups that we've seen. So they actually really are highly specialized. They only do this type of crime. And they have a business model of how to attack, what to attack, and stuff like that. So I think it's right. In your question, you said, yeah, there seem to be a hierarchy in there. And we definitely see all of those things, like a business model kind of thing, business-like structure. We see that in the ransomware groups. However, when you talk about all sorts of other fraud-related groups, like banking phishing, or you got all sorts of frauds aimed at individuals, you see that it's less, more like a business, and it's more, we call it cafeteria style offending, which means that it's much more opportunity driven, and it really resembles how traditional street gangs operate, because the traditional street gangs, they own a certain part of the city. In that part of the city, they deal drugs, they might have some prostitutes, and they might have other stuff dependent on the opportunities that they have there. They don't care. They are not specialized. They do all sorts of stuff. And what you see with a lot of the fraud groups is that they kind of work in the same way and that they are not specialized, which also means that the structure of the network is less hierarchical compared to, for example, the ransomware groups. Of course, there is somebody that you could label as a core member that thinks of the attacks that they're doing, but then they use all sorts of different facilitators and they work in all sorts of subgroups to carry out other attacks. So it's less of a formal group. It's much more a group that's more loosely connected, that do work together for maybe years, but kind of have all sorts of subgroups to do other criminal activities. And so that's a very different group compared to the ransomware group that I just described, because they are much more focused, they are specialized, and they do one thing and they do it good, while the other fraud groups are usually much more looking for new opportunities and just dive into that. And then, of course, we also have more individual offenders, because cybercrime is not only financially motivated. We also have the curiosity-driven hackers, or we have a hacktivist that, you know, hack because they have a certain political message that they want to spread. And also when it comes to hacktivists, you see that people work together, but the networks are getting created on a very different way. And I've also got one of my PhDs who's actively interviewing hacktivists, and you see that, yeah, they are completely different when you compare them to groups that are financially motivated, because they are building their relationships based on the motivation of changing the world, whether that be, yeah, against terrorist groups, or that can be against the government or whatever. That doesn't mean they have a political agenda, and that's how they recruit new people. And then, of course, there's a huge difference between the groups, because some of them actually try to get in people with specific technical knowledge, and they don't really care about how politically driven you are, while other groups really think that's important. So, but you basically don't have one type of cybercriminal network that you could say, this is how it works. So I already described three different types. And I think the most important thing that I have not really touched upon are all of the markets. And it used to be on the dark web and still on the dark web. But now you also have the Telegram groups and stuff like that, where it's, yeah, you just join the group and you can see who offers you a service that you want to use, and you just use it. So this enables, on the one hand, groups that are already active in some sort of criminal activity to also engage in cybercrimes, but it also offers more individual persons to actually be part of a network without being part of a network because they offer a service or they just use it and add something and sell it through. So that's a completely different model than what I see in most traditional crimes. And it's also different than your classical long-lasting criminal enterprise that has a hierarchy, that has a boss, that has a leader, whatever. So that's really changing, changing crime, right? It's changing how you can actually get into contact with new offenders or with people that have interesting skills that you don't have yourself or that the people around you don't have. But it also means that the attacks that we are getting as victims can, on the one hand, be from highly specific networks operating from Eastern Europe or Russia, but also from like homegrown Dutch or German criminal groups that are trying to, with low tech ways, trying to get money from us. And that makes it very difficult for victims, potential victims, to actually protect ourselves from those attacks because it's completely different. So I think that's really the interesting part of the cybercrime landscape, that it's so diversified. And yeah, that makes it very hard to actually tackle it, I think.
That was very illuminating. Thank you. Do you think that cybercrime is becoming more prevalent since, say, the early 2010s? What is the current trend?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think in the Netherlands, I think we are the only country that has already been using victim surveys since 2012 to actually measure on a representative sample of Dutch people how many people fall victim to hacking, a couple of cyber frauds, and some interpersonal crimes. And what you can see there is that, so what they have done since 2012, they measured the same five types of cybercrimes, and you can see that's stable. So hacking is about 5%, phishing about 2 or 3% or something like that. So we'd say, then there is no rise. But there is, because we're not measuring ransomware, which wasn't really existing in 2012. Theoretically, it could be done. Some papers were written, but it was not really an issue. Well, now it's one of the big issues, of course, in society. The same applies to new types of crime, new types of fraud that didn't exist in 2012 that we now know for sure are happening. So we see that a couple of crimes have stayed stable. There is no drop in any cybercrime that we're measuring, while we know that new crimes have arisen. So we know for sure that we see more victimization. And what we also see is that next to the highly specialized high-tech criminal networks, we see that the traditional criminals are actually adopting cyber, meaning, yeah, there are more and more digital opportunities to commit crimes. They are already doing this, so they're not going to stop. So this will only be more and more and more of cybercrimes and digital crimes that will be committed. Yeah.
I have a follow-up question on one thing that we haven't really covered yet, and that's social engineering. I was at a workshop a couple months ago where we went through several case studies of cyber attacks. You know, we did a sequential analysis, step by step, and some of the incidents were completely non-technical. That is to say that attackers gained access to data or networks almost entirely through social engineering. Could you explain what social engineering is and how prevalent it is in cybercrime?
Yeah, very good question. And I don't have any numbers about social engineering. And the reason for it is that social engineering basically means, I would say, talking in such a way that you think, I'm going to do this, right? It's all about convincing you to do something that you should not do. That's basically social engineering. And it can be by just telephoning you and saying, hey, I'm from the IT help desk. You know, we've noticed something going on your account. You need to log in. So I'm going to do it for you. Can you give me your, this is your username. Can you give me your password? Something like that. But also, hey, I'm going into this company with a cake. I'm going through security saying, hey, I've got this cake. I need to deliver it for this and this department. You know, I'm in a hurry. Can you let me through? Or use a letter or whatever. So basically it means, you know, using your skills as a human to actually make sure that you do something that you should not do. So social engineering can be used, as Kevin Mitnick has shown, just solely by telephoning people or doing those you know, walk-ins. But you can also use it in a phishing email. Basically, that's also social engineering is part of setting up a phishing email, because you set it up in such a way that you want the person that gets the email thinks, oh yeah, this is an email from the bank because I recognize it and accuse him that it's actually important and stuff like that. So social engineering can be used in many ways to improve your attacks. So that's basically why I don't think we can measure social engineering. And what you could say is that some of the more low-tech phishing attacks are actually basically pure social engineering attacks. Because what we've seen in the Netherlands, for example, and I'm sure it's the same in other European countries, that is that criminals like 10 years ago would send emails to people pretending to be from the bank, hoping that somebody would actually log in so they could have the login credentials. And then they would telephone the person saying, hey, I'm from the bank. Now they had access to the bank account, so they could say, hey, is it correct that I'm going to check? Is it correct that, you know, your last transfer was this and this and this? Okay, so you're actually this and this person. We've got a problem, and we're going to help you, and blah, blah, blah. So you use it to gain trust. But what you see now is that they skip the part of actually emailing somebody and getting into the system by just having lists of phone numbers of people and trying to just telephone them, saying, hey, I'm from the bank. We got a huge problem because I see at this moment somebody's trying to get 5,000 euros from your bank account. We can help you, but you need to install this on your computer. And they actually install a TeamViewer, giving the criminals access to the machine. The entry point is just telephoning somebody saying, we got a problem. You need to solve it now. We're going to help you. This is how you need to do it. And do people do this? Yes, people do this. This is a huge problem at the moment in the Netherlands. And it's interesting because it's becoming less and less technical, right? The first part of the attack is not emailing or setting up websites. It's just telephoning somebody. And of course, the TeamViewer, you could say it's technical, but it's also something that everybody can use. So I also think that's interesting that you see the more fraud-related groups still using technology, but more and more depending also on their social engineering skills, because that turns out to be very important in those crimes.
Generally speaking, on the state of play of combating cybercrime in the EU, do you think the situation is improving? Are we getting better at fighting cybercrime?
Yeah, I think it's definitely improving, but the criminals are improving as well. So that's, of course, the main issue. So I'm happy that we don't have the same situation as 15 years ago when it comes to tackling cybercrime. But, you know, we're heading in the right direction, but the problem is getting bigger and bigger. So we also need to keep improving. And to give one example, in the Netherlands, because it's a small country and it's easy to understand, before 2007, we did not have specialized cyber teams at the Dutch police. So, of course, there were some people, hobbyists within the police that were interested in it, but nobody really, there was not a team, so there was not a dedicated team. I think in 2006 or 7, something like that, we got our first national team high-tech crime. So they were fighting the high-tech crimes, international crimes and stuff like that. Very good, right? Because we needed that. But of course, that's only a small team. I think they started out with maybe 10, 20 people. It's now a couple of hundred, so it's good. But what we saw is that, okay, now we can actually catch some of the bad guys, but it's not much. So what we saw in, I think 4 or 5 years ago, that every region in the Netherlands, and we got 10 of them, every police region also has a cybercrime team now. So we now have one on a national level doing stuff with the UK, whatever, with Germany, with Belgium. And we got on a regional level, we got police teams that are actually dedicated to also carry out, police investigations against all of the groups that are not big enough or not international enough for the team high-tech crime, but are still making lots of victims in the Netherlands. Or in which case, maybe the offender is in the Netherlands or a lot of the victims are here, right? And the next step should be that, so now we have 11 teams. And I think if I have to take a wild guess, 300 people, 400 people working within the police, you know, to tackle these cybercrimes, on a total of 60,000 persons active in the Dutch police. So I think the next step is, it's very good that we have the team anti-crime, and it's very good that we have the regional teams that are still specialized, that everything below understands that they also need to be able to address cybercrimes, because many of the frauds, they're not high-tech, they're not spectacular, innovative, or whatever. But we see a lot of victims, and we see a lot of offenders actually located here or close to the Netherlands. So we now need to make the next step of making sure that the entire or a huge part of the police organization actually tackles crime. Because we know when we look at victimization rates, it's much higher if you compare it to the rates of the police officers actually trying to tackle cybercrime. So if you look back 15 years, we're doing great, but we're not doing good enough yet. And I think what we're seeing here, you could also apply to other fields of cybersecurity. So we got more cybersecurity companies, we got more collaboration, public-private partnerships, et cetera, et cetera. We got better policy, better regulation, but it's not good enough yet. So we're actually making very good steps, but it's not enough, and we need to keep developing it. It's an ongoing thing, and it's not something that we're going to solve in the next 5 years. This is something that will always be part of our society. So we need really to keep investing in tackling cybercrimes.
So finally, what advice would you offer to aspiring or young professionals, you know, who are eager to or interested in the cybersecurity field, particularly cybercrime?
Yeah, do it. It's very important. And I think this is the future. If you're interested in crimes or deviant behavior, this is or technology, this is the place to be, right? This is where interesting things are happening. This is where the most urgent societal problems, or not the most, but very urgent societal problems are arising here. And because we're losing the battle if young people don't join this game. And I think it's very important to also make it very clear that we need technical people, but we also need non-technical people that actually understand that technology is important, but use their own skills, like whether it's psychology or whether it's political science or criminology, it doesn't matter. We need those skills because this is not an IT problem. It's partly an IT problem, but it's way bigger than that. And I think that's very important for people to understand. And we need to have a new breed of scientists and young professionals that actually understand that it's not about IT or not IT. It's about a problem. And we're going to use technical people to actually help us, or technical people are going to use us to better understand the idea, and we're going to work together. And I think I really hope that we get more people that understand it and that they're not afraid to talk to each other. And actually, just like the criminals don't care about whether you're a techie or not. They care about, do you have skills that can help us make money? What we should have is, we need to think about, does somebody have the skills to help us solve this problem? And it can be technical, social, whatever. And then team up and do it. I think we can learn from the criminals here.
Well, that's all the questions I have for you today. So thank you so much again, Rutger, for appearing on our podcast.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me. Very interesting topic. So I really hope that some of the people listening to this think, yeah, this is definitely something that I'm interested in, and I'm going to pursue a career in fighting against cybercrime.
And that's all for today. Thank you for tuning in. If you're interested in learning more about international security and cybersecurity in particular, follow the Center for International Security at the Hurdy School on all our channels, including X, that's at Hurdy_security, Blue Sky at hurdysecurity.bluesky.social, or LinkedIn. If you're interested in a master's degree in international security, please check out the Hurdy School's Master's in International Affairs. We offer a fantastic degree with a focus on international security. Next episode, we will be looking at how states use digital and cyber means to repress their populations. Until then, this is David Bukowski from Berlin.